Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Part of the world that is now at war, it appears, in a way that we have perhaps not quite clearly understood, is Southeast Asia, notably Thailand, which suffered a devastating attack yesterday on one of its tourist attractions, a sacred shrine. Joining us to talk about that is Dr. Zachary Abuza. He is today a principal at Southeast Asia Analytics, former professor at Simmons College and the National Defense University. Dr. Abuza is also the author of several books relevant to our present topic, Conspiracy of Silence, The Insurgency in Southern Thailand, also Political Islam and Violence in Indonesia. Dr. Abuza, welcome. It's good to have you with us, I believe, for the first time.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
We're anxious to get your sense of what happened in this attack, obviously designed to have a murderous effect, but also the leadership of Thailand is saying it is an act of economic warfare as well. What are your thoughts on who perpetrated this and why?
Right now, we really do not know. There are different suspects out there. The Thai police have just released today a photograph or a picture of a suspect. They are labeling him a foreigner, not a Thai. But other than that, we really don't know. There have been questions whether it was southern insurgents, who certainly have the technical capacity to pull off an operation like that. But for the most part, they have stayed in the deep south, where ethnic Malay separatists have been fighting for 12 years for their own state, or at least significant political economy. And they have increasingly been going out of area, targeting tourist venues, maybe not so much that focus or attract Western tourists, but Malaysian or Chinese tourists have been targeted in the past. But it seems unlikely that it was them, just because the backlash would be too great. It would be counterproductive. And so I think a lot of attention is focusing on transnational threats. But the question is, why Thailand? You know, what do groups stand to benefit from such an attack? And there have been suggestions that perhaps it's Uyghurs, because Thailand recently deported 109 Uyghurs back to China in very dreadful circumstances, hooded, handcuffed. But despite Chinese assertions of Uyghur radicalism, I've never been able to point to Uyghurs being part of a terrorist act.
A few of them were incarcerated in Guantanamo Bay, of course, in connection with their association with some of these jihadist enterprises. But let me ask you, you have been writing about the Islamic State's emergence in the region. Is it, in your view, a distinct possibility that this is an act of theirs? And again, the question would arise, why Thailand?
I think that's a very fair question. Point right now. You have roughly 600 Southeast Asians who have joined with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. they have their own company of Bahasa-speaking fighters. They're just that many. They have schools, their own communities over there. Very quietly, this got very little attention and certainly none in the Western media, but there were two plots in Kuala Lumpur, in neighboring Malaysia, that police broke up in kind of the final stages. And so they are starting to come back to Southeast Asia. They are starting to plot terrorist attacks. And so this very well could be tied to the Islamic State.
One other question. There have been some, Dr. Zachary Abuza, who have claimed that this might have been a provocation by the military, which is now running the country, to sort of justify further crackdown domestically, perhaps on some of these insurgencies, perhaps just to, you know, assure its hold on power. Do you credit that as a possibility?
No, I don't. The military has their hold on power. They've pushed back elections to 2017. They will already had low-level attacks by red shirts used to justify their continued hold on power.
The red shirts, of course, being part of the political opposition.
Right. And, you know, they will use the imminent death of the king to hold on to power in a transition period. You know, the military is in trouble right now. They're losing a lot of the supporters, even people that supported the coup back in May 2014, because of the mishandling of the economy. And I just could not see them perpetrating such a major attack against a religious symbol that would devastate the tourist sector, which is so critical for the country. You're talking 25 million people a year.
It really is economic warfare to have gone after something like this shrine. Professor, let me switch gears, if I may, because you have written recently in Asia Times Online about Vietnam, another important country, of course, in Southeast Asia. You headline it, "Vietnam Buckles Under Chinese Pressure." We spend a lot of time here at Secure Freedom Radio talking about what the Chinese are up to, both in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and more broadly in the region. There's no question that it is aggressive in character. Vietnam, of course, was subjected to an armed armada placing an oil rig there not so long ago. It's been removed. But you indicate that what the Vietnamese, who've had a history of fighting the Chinese, both kinetically and otherwise, seem to be capitulating. Is this evidence of a kind of new order in that part of the world in which Chinese hegemony is being acceded to rather than resisted? And what are the implications, if so?
All right. Well, first of all, that article was written roughly a year ago, kind of at the height of that, when the Chinese had placed this massive oil rig clearly on Vietnam's continental shelf. I mean, there could just be no doubt about it. And defended it heavily, sending in warships and maritime militia and their coast guard to protect it. And ultimately, they did withdraw, but that was more for the monsoon season. The Vietnamese really were in a bind. And ultimately, the Chinese sent a very senior Politburo member to Vietnam who gave no ground whatsoever. And the Vietnamese were very suddenly less assertive. And I think there was a lot of concern that they were buckling under Chinese diplomatic pressure.
And very quickly, we're almost out of time. Is that still the case, or have things turned around?
A very recent visit of the General Secretary of the Vietnamese Communist Party to Washington. And I think that signals that the Vietnamese are looking to really lessen their dependence on China and broaden ties to the United States. That the head of the Communist Party would come, not just the foreign minister, not the state president, but the head of the Communist Party would come, is very telling that the Vietnamese are very fearful of Chinese assertiveness.
Dr. Zachary Abuzo, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you for your insights into both of these important topics. We look forward to further conversations with you about this very strategically important part of the world. Keep up the good work at Southeast Asia Analytics and come back to us again very soon. Next up, my colleague Jim Hansen from the Center for Security Policy joins us to talk about the threat the FBI now perceives from American militias to U.S. mosques. What's up with that? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy, our executive vice president for the center. He is a former Army special operator, now a man who has turned his talents to waging the war for the free world through other means. The non-kinetic means of the Center for Security Policy are special forces in the war of ideas. Jim, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks, Frank.
I guess I'd like to begin a conversation with you about a report that WND is running today that says the FBI is issuing a warning about a new terrorist threat to the United States from what seems like a fairly unlikely source. They suggest it's American militias who are going to be attacking Muslim mosques and Islamic centers and so on. Do you credit this report? And if so, what do you make of it?
Well, Frank, I think one of the things that's been going on, and this dates back to 9/11, is this fantasy that Americans are going to start taking out their aggressions against Muslims and slaughtering them in the streets, attacking mosques and doing all these things. And I'm unaware of it ever happening. You know, that's the thing that makes it fantasy is it's one of those pieces of the countering violent extremism rather than battling Islamist terrorism mentality that I think has affected our government since then. This particular report says that there are militias out there that now are going to be attacking Muslims or mosques or whatever. They've got one or two anecdotal incidences where they found some militia member at some point discussing possibly killing a Muslim and putting a video on the internet. Okay, I'm sure at some point an FBI informant has heard somebody say that in the United States. And yet, has it happened? No. Have we had any incidents like that? No. And even the FBI, when forced to rate this possibility, which is the last piece of it, they said the possibility of it happening is actually low. So I think it's one of those situations where they want to focus on something other than the real problem, which is the jihadists in our midst, and go ahead and point at militias and stop there.
Or anybody else, constitutionalists, Tea Party folks, and on. You're absolutely right, Jim. This is the countering violent extremism meme. Jim Henson, the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, is with us. We're talking about the, well, I call it malfeasance of the Obama administration. And Jim, it seems much in evidence with respect to Iran at the moment. We're told that the government is now objecting to the transfer of SA-300 surface-to-air missiles by the Russians to the Iranians, that I guess they must also be objecting to the fact that the Iranians seem to be threatening the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency if he discloses anything that might shed light on what they're up to. There certainly seems to be a lot of pushback by the administration on Bob Menendez, the United States senator who has come out very recently, Democratic senator, saying this deal is not something he wants to be associated with. He doesn't want his name on the bomb, as they say. Give us a quick update on how you think things are playing out with respect to this this debacle of a Obama bomb deal.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's not Menendez's name that would be going on the bomb. This is the president's second legacy item after Obamacare, and as you said, it would be the Obama bomb. I think the issue right now is, do the Iranians actually want the deal to go through now in the United States Congress? Because as we recall, Obama took this deal to the UN Security Council first, and the UN sanctions, if lifted and if the conventional arms embargo and ballistic missile restrictions are lifted against the Iranians, they've got pretty much everything they need. They'll be back in the world community. They'll be allowed to buy weapons from the Russians and the Chinese and anybody else, and they'll be able to trade freely. I'm not convinced at this point that the Iranians see the U.S. as anything again but the great Satan. You know, they took Obama and John Kerry to the cleaners and got every single thing they wanted done in the negotiations. We got nothing. And I have a feeling now that with all the aggressive actions they're taking, they may be unconcerned about the U.S. Congress and the U.S. president and just be dealing with their new allies, the Russians and other folks, and leave us on the sideline.
Knowing that that the rest of the world has the same low regard for the Obama administration that they do and will be disdainful of any further efforts by the administration, if there are any, in fact, to dissuade them from doing business with Iran. And Jim, you know, one of the things that interests me, and I would talk about in the commentary today, is the fact that Had Robert Menendez not been effectively taken out by the Obama administration, we might not have the deal with Iran that we have today. We certainly would have a, I think, different situation in terms of congressional vetting of that deal. What are your thoughts on how this came about and the implications for both the content of the Obama bomb deal on the one hand and the, well, the treaty-making responsibilities of the United States Senate on the other, of what they did by prosecuting Bob Menendez in April?
Well, the Corker-Cardin bill essentially turned our Constitution on its head. It said that instead of the U.S. Senate and the Congress being a co-equal branch of government whose job is to advise and consent on anything as sweeping and broad anywhere near this Iranian nuclear deal, they decided then, no, we're going to go ahead and take what should be a two-thirds vote to approve what's essentially a treaty and make it a two-thirds vote to stop this train wreck from happening. And that happened because they managed to push Bob Menendez out from his position in the Senate where he would have been able to affect that. And that essentially is what gave the Corker-Cardin bill birth.
There would not have been a Cardin in that Corker-Cardin bill had there not been a Menendez taken out. Jim, let me turn to another topic, if I may. We've discussed it in the past, I think disagreed about it in the past. I'd be interested in sort of your current thinking on it. You are a former special operator in the United States Army, a Green Beret, as I mentioned. Your comrades in the Rangers training program have just approved two females who have made it successfully through the course. First of all, what do you think of that? And second of all, is there any indication that in the process there was any dumbing down of the standards by which their performance would have been evaluated and therefore perhaps affecting the accuracy of their passage of this very, very difficult, challenging program?
You know, there's a common saying in the military that the last hard course was the one I went to. And you guys now have it easy. And I think that's already starting regarding whether these women passed under standards that match the Ranger level. I have a good friend, Representative Steve Russell, who's a congressman, a former combat commander, retired lieutenant colonel, who went down to the Ranger school and talked with them at the start of the course and during the beginning of this training. And he came back convinced that they weren't going to dumb down the standards. So if they pass based on that, I applaud them. The difficulty now comes in what is the military going to do as far as employing females in the combat roles, combat positions, and other things like that. And I think we have now opened up a little larger can of worms than simply allowing women to get training, because we've got women running combat patrols now. You know, in combat zones, they've got women running supply convoys and doing other things where the training from Ranger School would be helpful. But it sounds like now they're going to remove the restrictions against women serving. It sounds like in the SEALs and in other places. And that is an entirely different can of worms. And I'm not sure that that's a viable way to run the effective military we have. So congratulations to the women who graduated. And good luck to the folks who now have to try to deal with social engineering in the military. It's farther than I was comfortable at going.
Jim, thank you for those insights on so many topics. Your work at the Center for Security Policy, as well as your previous service to our country in uniform, is really appreciated. Keep it up, my friend. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, bestselling author Diana West joins us to talk about the transformative effect Donald Trump is having on the immigration issue for Republicans and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. New Jersey's Robert Menendez yesterday became the second prominent Democratic senator to announce his informed opposition to the Obama bomb nuclear deal with Iran. He declared, quote, "If Iran is to acquire a nuclear bomb, it will not have my name on it," unquote. Interestingly, there may well have been no deal at all had Senator Menendez's name appeared somewhere else. Last April, Obama's Justice Department engineered his removal as the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In his absence, President Obama was able, in a display of negotiating skill and determination wholly absent from the Iran talks, effectively to eliminate the constitutional check on his ability to capitulate to the mullahs. So Senator Menendez's name won't be on their bomb, but a relative handful of congressional Democrats are poised to join Barack Obama in having theirs on it. This is Frank Affney. Learn more at irantruth.org.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here.
Do this better than any station in town.
Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. This week, Democratic New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez gave a powerful speech rejecting the nuclear deal with Iran, in which he said, "If Iran is to acquire a nuclear bomb, it will not have my name on it." Menendez also noted that he voted against the Iraq War, a subtle dig at President Obama's claim that opponents of the Iran deal are the same people who pushed the United States into the Iraq War. Menendez joined Senator Chuck Schumer, who announced his opposition last week. At least 10 Democratic House members are also opposing the deal. When former Democratic Senator and presidential candidate Jim Webb announced his opposition, he criticized attacks by Obama administration supporters on Schumer, which included questioning Schumer's loyalty to the United States. Members of Congress must ignore the increasingly desperate efforts by the Obama administration to defend the nuclear deal with Iran. Congress must vote to kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Diana West, one of our regular featured guests, is back with us. Diana, of course, is a longtime nationally syndicated columnist, now first-class blogger at dianawest.net. You can find her writings there on a whole host of issues, including one that I'm particularly anxious to talk with her, which is Donald Trump and his views on immigration. Diana, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be with you.
So you have written rather glowingly, I think it's fair to say, about the contribution that Donald Trump has been making to the Republican Party's positioning on the immigration issue. Give us a flavor of why that doesn't seem to be a universally held view, at least within party circles.
According to party circles, according to establishments, really across the spectrum, this is not something just to be identified on the right. From right to left, the establishment view is that immigration is not an issue to take to the people. And I think that we can look over the past decades and see how often this has happened to us, where the people have expressed a certain will by putting people in office, by showing their approval in various kinds of polls, including voting polls. And the elites do nothing, whether it's the border wall, whether it's immigration control, whether it's setting immigration policy and actually carrying it out, whether it's executing laws on the books, etc. Donald Trump has exploded this paradigm because he is not of the establishment. In the establishment, outside, he is the consummate outsider, including and especially because he is self-financed and he is not someone who came up through the system and has been conditioned to be a defeatist on the immigration crisis. And this is where we are. And because he's had success in the polls, you know, these are early polls, but he's had rousing success on the issue and attracted massive attention on the issue, he has changed the campaign forever.
We're looking at a, well, sort of tractor beam, to use a Star Trek term, effect on other political figures in this race, notably Scott Walker, who has undergone a rather dramatic transformation on it. Do you see, Dinah West, this actually permeating the establishment as well, or is this really going to be a campaign in which basically outsiders, people who defy what Ted Cruz calls the Washington cartel, are going to be likely the dominant force, whether it's Trump or one of the others, from here on out?
It could, only if the establishment sees it as a means of resuscitating itself. It really depends how deep this desire to remain America, for people to stand up for borders and these various points of Trump's very excellent immigration plan. Depends how much that becomes a mechanism of survival for the establishment. I don't see it. I don't see them coming to it except to dilute it, to neutralize it, to betray it, to co-opt it, yes, for their own purposes, which is power. I think that what's important about Trump is that he has exposed this cleavage between the establishment and Americans with these concerns, which I think are the very basis of patriots, you know, love of country, literally, between the establishment and Americans with these concerns. And he has also given voice to them on a national stage that I think does reawaken, or at least hold the possibility of reawakening the American spirit, in the sense that, again, getting back to this establishment meme, that this issue, immigration, is not to be discussed. We've seen this in other countries, whether it be Britain, you know, before 9/11, or here for all this time, where immigration is not considered fit for public discussion in any serious fashion. It has become such a third rail. And Trump, again, has exploded this concept and made it apparently a winning issue. And the establishment is trying to regroup. And I think you see that with National Review's editorial this week, which really is playing catch up with Trump, really trying to, they must be hearing or feeling tectonic shifts out there, because I feel that for a flagship publication like that to make a positive statement about Trump's plan in such grudging terms does reflect a pivot that, as you say, does it go into the establishment? We will see. But I think that it reflects a great feeling out there in conservative, in real conservative people circles, that this is the signal issue. And that's what Trump has done. And without him, none of this would be happening. We would not be talking about this, except insofar as we would be observing the success of Ann Coulter's wonderful book, Adios America. But I don't think it would go into the translation to the political power stage. We would just have another wonderful debate about, you know, Ann Coulter's excellent research, and it would be popular, you know, with book buying public, and that's wonderful. But here we're seeing a potential to translate it to political power, and that is, for me, extremely exciting and quite a positive development. And I just love the meltdown we're seeing in the elites around us over this.
Well, a statement on the Times that the National Review is considered kind of an establishment publication by you, because it has long been regarded, of course, as a spokesperson for the right. But Diana, let me ask you about one piece of this Trump plan that has gotten some notoriety. He was taken to task yesterday by Bill O'Reilly on Fox News over the 14th Amendment. Have you followed that debate about anchor babies and birthright citizenship and so on, and what's actually in the Constitution? Is Trump right that it ain't necessarily there?
I think he is right. I don't think it's hard to see the. It's not one of these complex constitutional issues amid. But just one further word on National Review. I think National Review is a flagship barometer publication of the right. It is considered where the polite right, the establishment right, does express itself, and has traditionally policed the right. We go back to the 1960s, we see the William F. Buckley very famously casting out the right wing of the right, the John Birch Society, which essentially did make the fight against domestic communist subversion a fringe concept. And then in the 90s, we see again this effort to expunge the immigration restrictionists as an institutional cause. I think it was Robert Bartley who called it, actually exulted over the fact National Review was abandoning immigration as a conservative cause or immigration restriction, of course, being editorial page editor of the very pro-immigration Wall Street Journal. So I think National Review is a very important conservative publication in that sense. And so, again, yes, it's an outlier in the media, but it is an establishment voice on the right, just to clarify.
Diana, in proximity to Washington, D.C., Frederick County, Maryland, there was a vote taken last night by the county council that rescinded a previous requirement that the county's business be conducted in English. This is evidence of yet another example of accommodation to this sort of wave of often illegal immigrants who speak Spanish. What are your thoughts on this vote and whether it in fact is a straw in the wind that we better be reckoning with and counteracting as well?
Yes, definitely something to counteract, to understand as a signal of cultural attrition. Immigration is not supposed to be transformation. When America has incorporated immigrants from all over the world, of course, primarily based from Europe in its founding centuries, it was not supposed to be something that would change us linguistically, culturally, to a point of non-recognition. Frederick County, however, has taken the opposite opinion that we should now become a bilingual culture. And this is something, again, that people need to really vote on. If this is what they believe in Frederick County, this is something for Frederick County to deal with. But this is also a national question, a question that all counties, states, localities, and nationally should be assessing. Is this what we want to do? Do we want to become bilingual, or predominantly in many areas, Hispanic culture? This is a question that is not, again, raised, even when we've dealt with the immigration issue in the past, the culture is as one of these aspects that has been off limits. It's usually been a matter of economics and just control, political control, things like that. Culture is the vital center, and an English-speaking country is the vital center of this country.
And no one understands these cultural issues better than you, Diana West. We thank you for your time, your marvelous books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, as well as your great writings at dianawest.net. Keep it up. Come back to us again next week, if you would. We'll be speaking with Brian Garst next about difficulties in southern Sudan, Greece, and beyond. After that, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration's efforts to defend the controversial nuclear deal with Iran has become ugly, very ugly. Last week, during a speech at American University, the president portrayed opponents of the deal as partisan Republicans in common cause with Death to America chanting Iranian hardliners. The Tablet, a daily online Jewish magazine, ran an editorial on August 7th claiming that the president is using code anti-Semitic language to criticize Jewish Americans for opposing the Iran deal and to blame them if the deal is rejected by Congress. Some liberal pro-Obama groups have gone further and have questioned the loyalty to this country of Jewish members of Congress who oppose the deal, such as New York Senator Chuck Schumer. The president and his supporters are stooping to smearing opponents of the deal because the agreement is so awful and they cannot defend it on its merits. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Brian Garst. He is the Director of Government Relations at the Center for Freedom and Prosperity. He is formerly a research assistant at the American Legislative Exchange Council and a foreign policy researcher at the Cato Institute. You can find his writings in numerous places, including Offshore Investment, The Daily Caller, China Offshore, and he has his own blog posts at briangarst.com. Brian, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's very good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
You have been following more closely than I, frankly, and I'm concerned about it. The drama playing out now in South Sudan, a country that was born of
considerable hardship and violence, but with great hope, and has once again found itself plunged into violence and economic hardship of a very considerable kind, particularly given its considerable oil wealth. Talk about what's happening on the ground there in one of the newest countries in the world, South Sudan.
Yes, absolutely. Right now in South Sudan, there's an ongoing conflict of about 2 years between the sitting president and his former vice president. And South Sudan is actually a one-party state, in effect, due to its formation as a formal rebel group of its own against the Sudanese government. And so 4 years ago, South Sudan achieved independence, and it had a elected government, a young democracy that the United States was one of many countries that helped get off the ground. And then 2 years ago, in one of those episodes that is somewhat common in the region, there was a falling out between the president and the vice president. The vice president was dismissed from his office, and an armed conflict began through their presidential guard. Some loyalties went to different sides, and the fighting spread, and over time it's grown into this burgeoning civil war. The fighting's been off and on. It's not full-blown in the sense that it's out of control, but it's obviously a big humanitarian crisis. You know, a lot of people have been displaced from their homes.
And great hardship for everybody, I gather, because of the economic disruption that's been associated with it. Now, you've written a paper at the Center for Freedom and Prosperity concerning the peace process that has been underway to try to alleviate the situation. You entitle it Stumbling Toward Peace in South Sudan. What is happening on that score, Brian? Is there actually any prospect that a negotiated settlement can be achieved? And if so, are we on track for that?
Right. That's a great question. And kind of what I delve into this paper is that there is prospects for peace here. Both sides have, at one point or another, they've come to the table. They have demonstrated at least a willingness to conceive of peace, which is always the first step and sometimes the hardest one. What I look at in the paper is how the international community is affecting that and whether or not what they're doing is productive towards that end. And unfortunately, one of the things that I show is that some of the strategies they're using are unlikely to produce a lasting peace. So as an example, the United States is threatening considerable sanctions in the region if the two sides don't agree to a proposal by a local bloc of African nations. And just within the last couple of days, the president has said that he would not sign that particular proposal immediately. And one of the things I put out in the paper is that the proposal itself would undermine the stability of the region. So right now they're proposing to reinstall the vice president into a new office called the first vice president, because, you know, since he's left, there's been another vice president. So they want to give him, and this would be a transitional government toward an eventual election, which I think is where you ultimately want to get. But between here and there would be a considerable amount of time with this vice president installed and given basically veto power over the actions of the president. So they would basically have to come to agreement on any action.
And we're told that the United States government is working at the United Nations at the moment to sort of foist this deal on the government of Sudan and to, I guess, sanction it if it doesn't go along. Is that advisable in your judgment? And again, Brian, if you would, and our guest is Brian Garst with the Center for Freedom and Prosperity. Why does this matter to us, what happens in South Sudan?
Right, and that's the ultimate question. You know, what are the U.S. interests in the region? And depending on who you ask, you get a different answer. It seems to matter quite considerably to the president a lot.
This is President Obama you're talking about.
Right, yeah, President Obama. His administration was involved in the lead-up to the independence vote for South Sudan. They obviously, that was negotiated before he came into office, the actual timeline of it, but they took a lot of credit for seeing it successfully off, and perhaps rightly so. But now with the region, you know, spiraling down and, you know, the president heading towards the end of his two terms and looking perhaps to build his legacy, there's a personal interest in it, perhaps one that's leading him down a misguided path.
And it is a misguided path, in your judgment, to be sort of compelling the government of South Sudan to go along with this arrangement?
Right. I think the way that they're going about doing it, setting arbitrary dates and saying that you have to reach not just agreement, but this particular agreement that might not be what the region really needs. Yes, I think that's counterproductive, and that's what I show in the paper by looking at, well, even just the formation of South Sudan. That process took many years. It took a negotiator who was willing to keep the international community at bay when they tried to overwhelm the process. And so some of what's going on here is, it's one thing, you know, the kind of the academic research does show that there is value in threatening the two sides if it gets them to the table. There's less value when they're already at the table and you're beginning to try to dictate terms.
Yeah, I hear you, and I think this is a matter of some concern, especially as it sort of fits a pattern of bullying friends and undermining them that we've seen a lot of in the Obama administration. Hey, Brian, let me turn quickly to another topic, which you've also commented on, again, at briangarst.com, and that is this, 3.0 version, I guess, of the Greek bailout. Talk a little bit about that. That's playing out in European parliaments today, I guess, their votes. Discuss what's at stake and how likely it is this is going to sort out properly.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, in their infinite wisdom and ability to learn from past mistakes, the powers that be in the EU, which essentially means Germany, has decided to bail out Greece once again. Basically, the bailout question we've dealt with within the United States, it's, you know, are you better off trying to avoid a little bit of pain, or are you just better off accepting it and letting them go through the process and reforming their economy?
Essentially compelling them to reform their economy as opposed to sort of propping it up.
Well, yeah, and, you know, forcing them to do it in a way that's, well, it's dictated by their own past actions, right? They've accumulated debt that they can't pay. At some point, they have to make structural reforms to, you know, a very generous pension system. You know, in Greece, they have an insane regulatory regime that makes it impossible for anyone to start a business without bribing half a dozen officials. And it's just not a place that is conducive towards economic growth at present. Their government's too big and they spend too much money.
And if they do bail them out, the Europeans, that is, you're likely to see that arrangement persist, I fear. Brian, this is a subject that we'll be returning to, I know. I hope we'll have a chance to do so with you in the near future. Thank you very much again for the work you're doing at the Government Relations Post at the Center for Freedom and Prosperity. Keep it up. Come back to us soon. We'll hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.